The Sunstone Theological Society presents Women's Roles in Social Institutions, Insights for Members of the LDS Church. Recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
SSML sponsorship, the theme for this session had to be sociological. As sociologists, we believe that our perspective can provide unique insights into religion, social behavior, social organizations, and the human condition. We also feel that it's important to focus on women. Traditional female roles are being challenged not only in this country, but worldwide. Technological and economic changes have transformed the nature of work we do, while demographic changes, that is, longevity and declining fertility, mean that women will spend a much shorter portion of their time in childbearing. At the same time, there's been a great ideological movement in support of more equal power distribution between men and women. These changes, I think, have increased the tension between religious norms, traditional religious norms, and the broader societal goals and expectations. This tension may be especially great for Mormon women. And we're convinced the resolution of this tension poses a major, if not the major, issue facing the LDS Church today. Unfortunately, sociological research on Mormon women is neither comprehensive nor plentiful. Without intending to ignore the few good efforts that have been made, my sense is that little information is collected, even less is available to most sociologists, and even less is analyzed. So today, we're going to borrow and compare. The borrowing involves extracting insights about women from the world at large. That is, we will take specific social institutions, and today we have time for three: family, science, and the corporation. We will distill the key insights about the roles, expectations, and treatment of women in these social institutions. The comparing, then, involves seeking for similarities or differences between women in these other social institutions and women in the LDS Church. We hope this statement of theme is specific enough to provide a coherent topic for our session, yet broad enough to allow each of the panelists some latitude to say what they feel they should say. We hope the discussion today will move us towards the understanding of LDS women, and in our optimistic moments, we hope understanding will lead to, will facilitate improvement. Now a word about our panelists. Marie Cornwall is a colleague at the Department of Sociology at Brigham Young. She specializes in the study of social organizations, social networks, and the sociology of religion. She is currently involved in a study of faith development. There are 100 good things I could say about her, having her office around the corner, but I'm sure you'd rather hear from me than hear me say all the good things about her. She will talk about women in the corporation. Our second panelist, Rex Cooper, is an anthropologist, but we believe he's also good enough to qualify as a sociologist. I became convinced of this on a one-week trip to Mexico, where we spent most of the time arguing about the pros and cons of qualitative and quantitative methodology. He's done extensive historical and cross-cultural analysis of the Mormon culture, and his current focus is on the Mormon family. I recommend him as a scholar and as a traveling companion. He will discuss the family. Susan Eberle is also a colleague in the Department of Sociology at Brigham Young University. Her dissertation examined the process leading to acceptance of papers for publication in a professional journal. She also teaches courses in the sociology of education. Thus, she comes as our expert on the sociology of science, and she will focus on women in science. I've asked each panelist to take 20 minutes to present their thoughts. Then we'll have time for discussion and questions. Murray.
I want to thank Tim for this opportunity to think about some of these ideas, and I've struggled a bit with what to say today because there is so much that could be said, and I decided that I would focus really just on three areas where there might be similarities that might teach us something about the experience of women in the church. And those three areas... Or the first area will be what has happened to women in our society or in society in general as societies become more complex, and what we frequently refer to as the public domain has been has moved from interpersonal face-to-face relations to what we call the organizational form. And that the introduction of corporate entities rather than natural persons. Now, I'll try and explain that a little bit more as we go on. The second thing is the effect of bureaucracy and hierarchy on women. Not only have we moved to organizational forms in our society, but those forms themselves have become very complex and much more bureaucratic. Many who studied the impact of that have argued that that is just an additional subordination of women. And then the third area I want to touch on is a little more specifically in looking at corporations and how corporations value certain type of skills over other skills or training or position over other skills or training or position, depending upon what the organizational goals are and what the impact of that is for the individuals. Let's go first to the notion of this corporate entities versus natural persons. James Coleman is a sociologist, has a book out called The Asymmetric Society. Basically, what he argues is that over the last 200-300 years, that our society has moved from mostly interaction of natural persons. Now, natural persons are people like you and I who have a physical body and can talk to one another, to corporate actors or corporate persons. And corporate persons are organizations. And organizations in our modern society must communicate with one another. Now, to give you a feel for what the impact of that is and how much change has taken place, some people have done research looking at the number of corporate entities, for example, whose names appear on the front page of the New York Times. This study was done between it looked at the New York Times front page for the years 1877 to 1972. And there was a movement away from mentioning personal entities, that is, individuals, and a movement towards the mentioning of corporate entities, such as IBM, General Mills, whatever, in 1972, such that 85 to 90% of the entities mentioned in 1972 were corporate actors. And you begin to talk about IBM as a real entity rather than some organizations that's made up in terms of people. And we do this with the church. You know, we always say, well, the church says. The church is made up of a lot of individuals, but since it has taken on this huge organizational form, we begin to view it as an entity of itself. And we don't break it down into the individual, so we begin to talk about it as a almost as a physical entity, just like we talk about individual people. Well, what has been the impact of that in terms of women? One of the things that's happened is that, and it's happened in a number of different organizations, is that women's task, which, let's say, in the middle of the 18th, 19th century, was very much defined in terms of care of, for example, the poor, care of orphans, and social welfare issues. These kinds of things were taken care of by women in their small ladies' aid societies. What happened as our society became more and more complex and went to the organizational form was that these organizational forms took over responsibility for welfare services. And when they did that, these responsibilities were placed under the administration of men, because it's men who were running the corporate entities. Men moved into those corporate entities because that was, they were in the public domain, while women remained in the private domain. So to demonstrate this, let me give you a quote talking about the experience of Methodist women at the turn of the century. It says here, "While women were engaged in the long and painful struggle for recognition of their gifts and talents in the institutional churches, their autonomy in the extra-institutional benevolent and mission societies was being eroded. With little consultation with the women involved, the Methodist Episcopal Church reorganized the women's missionary societies under the control of the Denominational Board of Missions in 1906, and 17 years later, the Presbyterian Church did the same, merging the women's societies into a male-run mission board. Other denominations followed suit in the 1910s and the 1920s. Well, what does that teach us about the experience of women in the LDS Church? Our experience, I think, really occurred much later in the 1960s with the advent of correlation. I've spent some time looking at that, and Jill Durr has documented the loss of both formal and informal power of women in the church as the move of correlation took those aspects that women had always dealt with, the care and socialization of children, welfare services, taking care of the poor, and organized them under the bureaucracy and administration of the church. And when you did that, they came under the administration of men. Now, the problem with thinking about this issue is that if you look at what was done with correlation, from what we know now about organizational theory, it was probably the right thing to do, because it took a very complex organization and tried to streamline it. And furthermore, the effect, for example, on the auxiliaries across the board were fairly equal. That is, Sunday school, young men, young women, Relief Society, and the primary, all of them lost power. The problem was that since women were only involved in those women's auxiliaries, then the women lost organizational power totally. So Sunday school has really lost more power in the church than any other organization, I suspect, in terms of the auxiliaries. But that wasn't a major problem, because the Sunday school has never been the domain of women. But when you look at what happened to the Relief Society and young women's organizations in an effort to streamline this bureaucracy, you can begin to see that when you take these complex organizations and give them the responsibilities they're usually women's, that women lose power and authority over their own work. Okay? And that seems to be a social process apart from the experience and the whole issue of priesthood. Okay, now, secondly, let's talk about bureaucracy and hierarchy. As these formal organizations began to take over these responsibilities, they also became more bureaucratic. Let me read to you some descriptions of what a bureaucracy entails, and see if you can hear some kind of ringing in your ears in terms of the church. A bureaucracy is a complex, rational division of labor with fixed duties and jurisdiction, stable, rule-governed authority channels, and universally applied performance guidelines. A horizontal division of graded authority or hierarchy entailing supervision from above. A complex system of written record-keeping. A predictable standardized management procedure with predictable standardized management procedures following general rules, and having a tendency to require total loyalty from its members toward the way of life the organization requires. Now, one of the things that sociology of religionists like to examine is the impact on religion as a religious group moves from a very small group where interpersonal relationships are encouraged and fostered to an institutionalized form of religion where bureaucratic and hierarchical procedures are introduced. And most of you are familiar enough with the LDS Church and how it's grown, that I don't think I need to, point out to you that Mormonism has become very, very bureaucratic and very hierarchical. When Joseph Smith organized the church in 1830, there were 6 members. Even during his lifetime, many of the members of the church had direct access to the prophet. Today, if you count the levels of authority in the church, we have prophet, quorum of the 12, 7 presidents, the first quorum of 70, area presidencies, regional representatives, state presidents, bishops, elders, quorum presidents, home teachers, and finally the home. I mean, there is a very rigid notion of ecclesiastical line that's developed over the years. Now, when Weber talked about the ideal type of bureaucracy, what he was envisioning was a total rationalization of process so that no errors would occur and everyone would understand exactly what they were supposed to do, and we'd have this sort of streamlined efficiency. Well, there are a lot of problems with bureaucracy, particularly for women. The major problem, of course, that we've experienced in the last 30, 40 years particularly, is the fact that women have very little access to the hierarchy and the bureaucracy. You couple that with the fact that bureaucracy operates on the notion of subordination and control. I mean, really, bureaucracy, its effort is to somehow control the behavior of the workers at the bottom so that we'll be very efficient and they will get the things done. So, now, consistent with this, then, what would be a feminist perspective on bureaucracy? In the feminist writings today, we really find 2 perspectives. One is, among the liberal feminists, that the way you provide equality for women is to provide them equal access to this hierarchy and bureaucracy. So, and you do that through affirmative action programs. Okay? The more radical feminists say, no, bureaucracy is antithetical it's antithetical to equality because it introduces super and subordinate relationships, and it's antithetical to community, and therefore our job is to search for alternatives. Now, for the most part, I think Mormon women feminists have really opted for the more liberal perspective. That is, let's have equal access to the hierarchy. I'm going to take the more radical feminist position and ask some questions in terms of what might be the experience in the church for women. Let's talk about really whether or not bureaucracy and hierarchy is good for the church. First of all, let's think. When Joseph Smith first began teaching this notion of the patriarchal order, and as I read and try and understand what they were thinking about, the patriarchal order was premised upon a notion of hierarchy that was understood in terms of generations. That is, it was a generation of hierarchy back to Adam. And we're all going to be related, and Adam's going to be in charge of all of us because he's our great-great-great-grandfather. But the notion, again, still is in terms of relationships, generation, family. With the increasing bureaucracy of the LDS Church, priesthood, I think we have lost the meaning of patriarchy, and priesthood has come to mean ecclesiastical line of authority. So the question I want to ask is, what have we lost about the meaning of priesthood, the meaning of a Christian community, when we emphasize bureaucracy and hierarchy over religious community. That is an issue that is not just for women. That's an issue for women and men and children. Okay, the second thing I want to raise is the question is, what do we lose in the family when we apply Weber's ideal type of bureaucracy to rigid family roles? That is a family in which father is in charge, mother is the next level of management, so to speak. The oldest child is the next level, so that we have this notion of hierarchy in the family. Everyone is assigned respective duties and responsibilities, and those duties and responsibilities are evaluated through stewardship interviews. That is a model. I hear more and more, particularly priesthood men, talking about family in terms of hierarchy and bureaucracy, which is inconsistent with what family sociologists are discovering about what kinds of family experiences are most conducive to personal growth. And that is a family where with a lot of cohesion, nurturing, comforting, and a lot of adaptability in terms of roles and responsibilities. Finally, to what extent does the bureaucratic form within Mormonism really endanger our religious community? The real question then that we probably have to address in terms of women and the bureaucracy and the hierarchy is, how do we bring back community within the religious culture? And what can Mormon women contribute by emphasizing and by working in terms of building relationships and building community and working against hierarchy and bureaucracy? Okay. Now, the third area that I want to mention briefly, organizations have also learned, or those who study organizations have also learned, that the most valued position in an organization is the position that can is most likely the organization to achieve its goals. For example, one example is a sociologist has given is in a French factory, where the maintenance engineers who derived power from their ability to repair equipment were really the most powerful individuals in the organization. The reason is that the deterioration and ultimate breakdown of the equipment was virtually the only uncertainty in the highly mechanized plant. When the equipment broke down, everyone else had to stop working. So the maintenance engineers were there to keep those engines working and to keep the factory working. And because of that, they were highly valued. They had a lot of prestige in the organizations among all the other groups. Well, what does that tell us about priesthood and womanhood within Mormonism today? I think one of the problems that we're faced is that in the last 20 to 30 years, priesthood has become much more valued than womanhood. And I think women are feeling that. Now, let's try and analyze why that's happening. Well, first of all, the church has really focused on growth. And the measure of growth is the number of stakes and wards that can be created and run. And what do you need, under our given definition of who does what, to create stakes and wards? You need priesthood bearers, and you need a certain number of them. The other thing that Mormonism has always emphasized is that the church can only be healthy if everyone is organized into family units, because the family unit is the smallest organization. Now, in reality, the family unit has never really been the basis of organization, because most people are not ever always in family units in the life cycle. They move in and out. Well, one of the reasons that I would like to posit that priesthood seems to be more valued today is because priesthood bearers are a scarce resource. They are a scarce resource relative to the number of stakes and wards that the brethren want to create. And they are a scarce resource relative to the number of women who want to be in a family unit. So as long as the ratio of men to women continues, and as long as the growth of the church is really understood in terms of stakes and wards, Now, and keep that in mind. There are other ways to measure growth and success in Mormonism than just number of stakes and wards. But as long as we're focused on those two things, I predict that priesthood will continue to be more valued than womanhood, unless we redefine what it is that the organization is really about. Okay. Now, we might want to discuss later, if we have time, really what the full implications of these things are. But one of the things, as I see it, is that what we are really about is not only to discover and redefine womanhood in Mormonism, but to redefine where we're going in Mormonism. Do we really want to go on to be this highly bureaucratic, highly centralized organization, or can we discover new and alternative ways of organization that would be just as effective and would be more conducive to the growth of both men, women, and children within Mormonism?
There's some chairs over here. If the people that are sitting down there would like to move over, that might be a good idea. I don't want to put that there. To start out with, I would like to make a disclaimer. When I generally talk about the issue that I'm going to talk about, sometimes considerable anger is directed at me personally. And I just want you to know that what I say doesn't necessarily reflect my own opinions. And I just try to say objectively what I see the situation to be. Essentially, what I want to talk about is the issue of female subordination, especially as this applies to the family. And in 20 minutes, I'm going to try to make a rough, extremely rapid movement across cultures and through time and end up with the Mormon Church, and we'll see if I can succeed at this. And you must realize that everything I say is quite general and the specifics might differ from this. I am essentially trained in British social anthropology, and British social anthropology was very much influenced by the writings of Sir Henry Maine, who is regarded as the father of comparative jurisprudence. And therefore, social anthropologists tend to see relationships in terms of legal terms or in terms of formal rights and duties. Based on this type of understanding, I want to start talking about what I mean by subordination. Using that kind of definition, you might say that it refers especially to women as systematic exclusion from positions of power and authority and control of economic resources. To the degree women are excluded from positions of power and authority and control of economic resources over which men have control, it could be argued that women are in a subordinate position to men. Sir Henry Maine, in trying to analyze the position of women in a number of different legal systems in Europe and in India, concluded that historically the predominant characteristic of the woman to the man was one, he said that the woman is under the perpetual tutelage of men, or there is a perpetual guardianship of men over women. And he found this in a large number of societies, that women, you might say, are perpetual minors. They never achieve full adult status within the society. And I want to try to go into this and explain a little bit what he is talking about. To do this, it's useful to turn to the thinking of Meyer Fortes, who just recently died, who was a British social anthropologist. In trying to understand the relationship between larger society and the family, he drew a distinction between what he referred to as the political jural domain and the domestic domain. The domestic domain is kind of everything that happens in the household. The political jural domain is what exists outside the household, specifically legal regulations and norms and conventions that govern the interaction of people outside the household. Now, what Fortes says is that the conditions in the political jural domain very much impact on conditions in the family. So that if, for example, in the political jural domain, if men have a superior status to women, this will end up having an impact within the family. He goes on to talk about what he means by full jural maturity within the political jural domain. When a person is granted full rights of citizenship, this is what this consists in, They have actual or potential control over property or productive resources. They have economic control to a degree. They have rights of access to ritual powers and institutions. They have rights of citizenship, including the right to, in primitive societies, to sit on moots that decide legal issues and to engage in warfare. In all of these situations, traditionally, in many societies, women's access to these things is not as complete or as full as is that of men. In other words, women do not have full access to economic control. They do not have full access to ritual powers and institutions traditionally. And they do not generally have the right to sit on councils and to engage in warfare. And therefore, in this sense, they are perpetual minors, never complete citizens. Now, we're using this as kind of a model. I want to go on and talk about a few things that apply to women. First of all, it might be good to understand a little bit why does this subordination of women tend to exist throughout the world. Currently in the literature, there are two basic that I think are useful ways to look at this. The first is a Marxist perception, I guess that's the correct word. It's basically based on the writings of Frederick Engels, The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. He basically argues that the differential, the subordination of women is based on the fact that women are denied complete economic control that men have. And so that you don't think this is too radical, that's essentially what George Bush said last night in his acceptance speech. So we're not too radical here in saying this is a Marxist perception. I guess it could be a Bushian perception also. Anyway, Engels argues that in very primitive societies, there was no private property. By this he meant that no individual really had autonomous rights to control property and to accumulate it. These were hunting and gathering societies. They had no surplus, and the commodities were distributed by fixed convention, and everybody pretty much would get enough to eat, and there wasn't too much left. And therefore, men and women had essentially equal economic position within the society, and that he argued there was a division of labor, but he argues there was essentially equality. But as private property developed, Engels argues that men gained control over this property. They could accumulate it. Women, on the other hand, became involved in the care of children, and therefore men gained power over women. That's essentially what he is saying. Another way to look at this is from a functional perspective. Functionalism in anthropology tries to describe discuss social conventions in terms of what is necessary or essential for the perpetuation of the group as a whole. This argument states that in order for a society to exist, you need to have children born in that society. Somebody needs to train them and take care of them until they become adults. It says that the way this has been done is by restricting women essentially to the domestic domain. It ensures that women are there to have children and to take care of the children. And this is the reason why you find this condition. I think both of these arguments probably are limited, but both have some value in understanding the situation of the subordination of women. Now I've got through that little introduction. Now I want to talk a little bit about how these things hold up among primitive societies throughout the world. First of all, I should be clear that there's no such thing, at least it never has been found by an anthropologist, what would be regarded as a matriarchal society where women govern or women are in control. It's unclear whether or not there's ever been found what might be regarded as an equalitarian society for women have the same status as men, but there might be some, but other people would argue there even isn't this. But the degree and nature of female subordination varies widely from society to society throughout the world. Among hunting and gathering bands, across the board, this pretty well substantiates Engels' belief in the relationship of private property to female subordination. Women tend to enjoy a fairly high status in primitive societies, in hunting and gathering bands. did I not quite say that right? I want to talk about hunting and gathering bands where there's no agriculture, no domesticated animals, and really no surplus. And women tend to have fairly high status. The group as a whole is really essentially an extended family. It's a group of families together, so there's not a real sharp distinction between the domestic domain and the geopolitical domain. And so women have a fairly high status in this type of society. However, as agriculture and the domestication of animals comes into the picture, the relationship of women to men seems to change quite a bit. There's two basic variations on this. The first is what would be regarded as a patriarchal agricultural or pastoral society. In a patriarchal society, property passes through the male line from fathers to sons. Women are born into what is called a patriline, as are boys, but upon marriage, women go and live with their husbands, and they have no economic rights, per se, within their husband's patriline. The husbands control the property, and they have claim on their husbands for maintenance, but they really have no control over productive property. In these societies, divorce is somewhat possible, but it's quite complicated generally, because for the woman to go back to her patriline where she was born, her brothers have to return the bride wealth that they were given when she married her husband. And it's very hard to do this because they generally have used the bride wealth to acquire wives themselves. And so generally the woman is extremely dependent upon her husband. And this is generally in primitive societies where you find the greatest subordination of women. In contrast, I've got to move really fast, are matrilineal societies. Matrilineal societies are not governed by women, but property passes through the female line. As a result, women have autonomous rights in property independent of men, and this gives them considerable freedom, especially if you have a situation that matrilineal descent, I don't want to get too complicated here, is coupled with what is called uxorial local residence, where the man moves in with the wife. This is the way it is among the Iroquois, the Zuni, and the Navajo, for example. So the woman essentially owns the house. She owns, or essentially, her brothers have control over the agricultural or agricultural livestock, but they're off taking care of their wives, and so the women tend to have quite a bit of control over property also. In these types of societies, women have much more leeway within the household. Divorce is very possible because the woman suffers no economic liabilities by divorcing her husband. In fact, they could have an argument and he could come home and find his clothes on the front porch, and then he's got to go back and live with his mother and sisters. And so perhaps from a female perspective, this would be the most desirable kind of society if you have to live in a primitive society. I want to make one more statement here, is that liabilities of women, that women suffer in larger society, do not necessarily mean that they don't have a lot of authority within the domestic domain. Partly it's because they have power over the children. They raise the children, they're in the household where the husband sometimes is off a lot, and so even though men have a lot of control within larger society, very often within the household is a condition of what is referred to as matrifocality, where the household is really, in terms of power, centered upon the mother, because the husband provides economic goods and technically has control over them, but she's really the one that's utilizing them, and she's really the one that's taking care of the children. Now, I've kind of given that wide general perspective. I want to now kind of focus in on historical perspective in terms of the context, in terms of which the church emerged, and talk about female subordination. For this, I want to turn first to England and then to Puritanism, because most converts to Mormonism were either from English backgrounds or from Puritan ancestry, and so these two themes very much influenced not only the development of America, but the development of the church in particular. So let's turn first to England. Historically, in England, women were disenfranchised. They could not vote. They could hold essentially no political office. However, the subordination of women is more clearly manifest in the common law. The common law emphasized the subordination of wives to husbands.
The common law defined the husband-wife relationship by suspending the legal personality of the wife. In other words, before the law, the husband and wife were one person, and that person was the man. When a woman married, the husband gained control over all of her personal property, except for what was regarded as paraphernalia, things like beds. And he owned it by marriage. He gained control over her productive property, like land. He managed it, even though he didn't own it outright. The wife could not sue anyone in court, not even her husband. She could make no contracts. She, in a sense, had no legal standing before the law. And so you see, she was under the perpetual guardianship of her husband as long as she remained married to him. These laws continued well into the Victorian period, some of them into the 20th century. Expressing kind of this condition was versed by Alfred Lord Tennyson, for he said, "Man for the field and woman for the hearth, man for the sword and for the needle she, man with the head and woman with the heart, man to command and woman to obey, all else confusion." Now, in Puritanism, which were English settlers in New England that went there for religious purposes, essentially, this notion in the English common law persisted. It was raised very much to a religious principle. The Puritans saw everything in terms of hierarchy. If ever you had two relationships, one had to always be superordinate and the other one subordinate. Within the family, the man was seen as superordinate to the wife. I'm quoting from Edmund Morgan, who wrote on the Puritan family, that the husband, he says, stood before her in the place of God. He exercised the authority of God over her, and he furnished her with the fruits of the earth that God had provided. And so he was before, he was her God in some sense. And I'm sure some of you are aware of the same types of statements in early Mormonism. However, according to the marriage contract, he could not command her to do anything that was contrary to the will of God, which you also hear these statements in early Mormonism. But he had this religious domination over her. Now, in the religious congregation, she had fairly high status because she could become a covenant member of the congregation and therefore determine who could and could not become a covenant member of the community. But she could not be a minister, and she could hold no political office. Now, early America, some of the harsh realities of Puritanism were modified, but the English common law persisted in America, and America adopted it as the law of the land, and it was essentially the law of the land when the church was organized. And now I turn to Mormonism very briefly. Now, first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the pre-Nauvoo period. The general perception in secular society of the subordinate position of women had their correlates in Mormon society. They essentially seemed to accept it without question. You can see this in early writings. Joseph Smith, for example, talking about conversion, said you had to consult the head of the house, and then if he gave his permission, you could preach the gospel to his wife. But he also said husbands should be kind to their wives, for a wife should be obedient to their husbands. An article in the Elder's Journal states, "It is the place of the man to stand at the head of his family and to be lord of his own house, not to rule as a tyrant. It is the duty of his wife to be in subjection to her husband at all times, not as a servant, but as one who in meekness and the love of God regards the laws and instructions of heaven." So she should be meek before him because this was the desire of heaven. You find this subordination of wives to husbands in the law of consecration and stewardship because it was really assumed and written to the forms that the steward over the property would be the man, and then the wife was given rights into that stewardship. And she could continue to have those rights if the man died and she had claim on the property, but it really was he who managed it. You find it in patriarchal blessing. Joseph Smith seemed to be preaching their independence of women. However, while this was occurring, the First Presidency wrote to the women of the Relief Society and said, see if I can find it, and essentially that women should be jewels in the crown of them who, just a second, may God in his may God add blessings upon your heads, that you may be an ornament unto those to whom you belong. And so even in the Relief Society, there seemed to be this notion of subordination. Now, after the Nauvoo period, it seems within the household, this became more solidified in the statements that were made by the brethren. Now, And I could go through there, but I'm all out of time and have 15 seconds left. So I will just briefly state that today this same formal subordination has continued within the church. However, I was going to bring in the fact that in larger society, the position of women has continued to improve in the labor force, in legal rights. And so what we have in the church today is what Robert Merton would refer to as sociological ambivalence, in which we have the church giving one message, the society giving another message, and it's generating considerable confusion within the church as to which is the correct message. When the church says that you should be equal partners within the household, but that somehow the husband presides, at least in my own mind, it doesn't quite resolve how you resolve hierarchy and equality by saying you're equal, but one is the senior partner, one's the junior partner, and the second part of my paper I wasn't able to develop that, but at least I hope with this paper you've been able to see some of the historical trends that have gone into the forming of the conditions within the church. Okay, thank you.
Charles Dickens once wrote, "We had everything before us, and we had nothing before us," in A Tale of Two Cities. It is with this kind of ambivalence that I address the topic of women in science, insights for members of the LDS Church. And I was so glad that you ended up on the subject of ambivalence, because I plan to discuss at the end the contradictory and ambivalent messages sent. So this will be a very good place to take off. Some of this ambivalence comes because the story of women in science is the story of an elite group. An elite group of women who have had the opportunity over the last 20 years to enter this traditional male profession. The other side of the story is that working women in general are concentrated in lower paying and lower status occupations. For example, in the fields of biology, chemistry, and physics, the largest proportion of women are in biology and biology-related fields. Many of them are teachers. And they still consist of only 7%, according to a recent national survey, while approximately 50% of the workplace is women. From the publication Hard at Work, Women in the Utah Labor Force, we still find that while women are making inroads into certain male sanctums of employment, in some sense, occupational segregation by sex is just as pronounced as it was at the turn of the century. Women tend to remain in jobs where more than half of their co-workers are the same sex. This means that women still show a disproportionate tendency to major in humanities, education, and nursing. So what's the problem? We know that girls start out about the same as boys, that they're equally curious about their environment, and they're excited about the world around them. Yet by the time they are in high school, they are lagging behind. This in itself is a tragedy because it curtails free choice at the young adult level, which is central to our religious doctrine. But when you combine this with the feminization of poverty in our country, the many single-parent homes where women are not able to earn enough at a pay level high enough to support their families, it is more than a tragedy. It becomes a social problem. We live in an age of scientific progress. We have more education. We have a higher standard of living. We have had a knowledge explosion and a technical revolution. And so I ask, why aren't women choosing science? This is where most of the progress has been made. And for those women who are choosing science, where are the female Einsteins? When we ask why more women aren't choosing science, we are still confronted with the nothing before us. We still find the answers in gender-based socialization practices, educational inequalities, and institutional inadequacies. My purpose is to address some of the implications of these questions, not to attack anyone's personal behavior or lifestyles or values or religion. In fact, this is not a problem that pertains to Utah or to the Mormon Church or even to the United States. This is a problem which pertains to Western society. I'd like to present some data, briefly explain why socialization, academic training, and institutions contribute to the problem, and then interpret these findings in light of our religious experience. Subtle and not so subtle discrimination is keeping young girls from choosing science careers. They are further discouraged. First is discrimination. They are further discouraged by the lack of role models in these fields. Math is the critical filter. The day you quit taking math, you close doors to science. And most of our young women stop taking math after junior high. Earlier research investigated the possibility of biological sex differences. The existence of a math gene was even considered. Research does not bear this out. In fact, girls who stay in math end up with higher grades frequently than boys in math and science. Instead, the lack of support is shown in the schoolrooms, in the institutions. Teachers hold lower expectations of girls. Parents allow girls to get lower grades in science. Counselors push girls to alternatives, saying that physics and chemistry will lower their GPA. Mothers say, well, I wasn't that good at math either. And girls take alternative courses such as photography and physical therapy and other such available courses that satisfy science requirements. In real-life data collected this year from Utah schools about male and female experience in science classes, Professor Dale Baker from the University of Utah looked at three local schools, and I won't identify them. There were 197 students, 121 males and 76 females. And this was in biology, chemistry, and physics classes. As you might expect, biology is a required course now for college entrance. And so the numbers decreased as you move from biology to chemistry and to physics. She was there for 3 months of class observations for 60 total hours to look at the different messages that are sent, the contradictory messages, the differential association messages that are sent to girls and boys. She didn't walk in and say, aha, I knew it, and walk out. She spent a lot of time content analyzing academic interactions between teachers and students. And these are interactions where you ask higher order questions that cause people to think or that cause them to recall information from their textbook reading or from their homework assignments. She looked at procedural questions. How do you care for the Bunsen burner? What are the safety procedures? And that kind of a thing. She looked at social interactions. Well, what did you think of the game last weekend? Or, my, you look cute today. Those kinds of interactions. And disciplinary interactions. In addition to that, she looked at whether the communication from the teacher was terminal, meaning, oh, fine, and move on to the next student. Or was it what's called sustained interaction, where you continue helping the person you're speaking to think and explore further what they have answered in your classroom. And as expected, she found that there were more, and she used the chi-square method of analysis, which basically takes into account the different proportions in the classroom so that we can't simply say, well, there were more boys, so there were more boy interactions. She took a chi-square analysis of this. And what we basically find out is just what you expect, that boys lead in academic, procedural, and disciplinary interactions. That's no new news. And that girls are this is all statistically significant. The girls receive the most social interactions. You look cute. How was the dance? Those kinds of things. And in addition to that girls received more terminal responses from teachers and less encouragement to continue to think and explore the scientific issues that were at hand that day. And who do you think got the least attention of all? The smartest girls. In addition to these educational inequalities, differential socialization occurs in our homes and in our society. And there's an example, which many of you may know of the classic study in which babies were dressed in yellow, pink, and blue, and adults were invited in to interact with them. And it was found that the adults didn't know how to interact with the yellow babies. Said, I don't know whether this is a girl or a boy, and I don't know how to interact with these babies. And so we carry this baggage with us through most of our life. Further, girls get less encouragement to be independent, curious manipulators of their environments. Group further fosters traditional feminine behavior. The term dependent used to be used in research to mean under-socialized, and the term aggressive used to be used as a substitute for over-socialized. That means that if we are over-socializing our girls in American society. That means that they are less than fully socialized members of society. In one of my favorite shows, Camelot, the king is seeking advice about women, and he is told by Merlin, never be too disturbed if you don't know what a woman is thinking. They don't do it very often. Another negative stereotype is of science itself. Scientists are perceived as quiet, unsociable, not good-looking, out to lunch, and not with it. This opposes the value that we place on sociability, fluff, talkativeness, and looks for girls. Girls get the clear message that what they do socially is more important than what they do academically, particularly after junior high. A final barrier is the lack of a perception of the future usefulness of science, major role of women as wife, mother, and homemaker. Institutional barriers include a lack of power once in, a poor opportunity structure, and a weak reward structure as we continue to have mostly tokens in science. Institutions use what I call a ready, fire, aim approach. They've got this great program. It may even be government dictated, maybe even affirmative action, and they're ready to fire it, but they don't know where to aim it. and they don't know who to get. And so they just blindly recruit. Let's get one. But the program's there first. It's not for individual needs. Changes in the educational system, the socialization practices alone will not bring about change. Institutions must also alter. Teachers must alter. Parents must alter. Managers, people hiring must alter to bring about meaningful change. So what kinds of comparisons can we bring from this information in the LDS Church? A basic problem, and here we are, is the existence of contradictory messages, which at a minimum produce a highly organized, efficient, compartmentalized life, and at worst, schizophrenic workers. A basic condition of these double messages is the inconsistency between the verbal communications and the meta-level communications, which consist of the reward systems. The meta-level messages to achieving girls appear to convey a fearfulness of achievement. Girls' success, in fact, is still perceived as a threat to their future marital serenity. I have many examples personally to relate to you in a second, as well as data on the profiles that have come from the research of Tim Heaton and Kristen Goodman of overeducated, overachieving, undermarried single women versus undereducated, underachieving single LDS men. And I have several quotes from women in science to back up these points. One says, "I am embarrassed to say that my reason for switching from medicine to nursing is that I want to be married and have a family." Another says, "I don't want to go out in the world and be someone's wife. Most of the women I know feel you need your own accomplishments first and to know yourself so that you can bring something to a marriage." Another from Atlanta says, "Women are still trained very well to succeed at being women, as the community defines it. But I think they face more conflict than their mother's generation because of the traditional upbringing and are increasingly breaking down. They're exposed to new models of success, but they aren't very well trained or equipped to step into them." Another one, "I have been advised more than one time that men really don't like super competitive women. They like to have the edge. It's not that they teach you not to achieve, but they don't want you to take it seriously." Just a few more. "I've had 5 job interviews so far. In every single one I've been asked, do you have any commitments holding you back? One representative even asked to see my left hand." Another one, "I think women are perhaps taught to behave in terms of their manner and demeanor in a fashion that I might describe as constantly pleasant. Some women find it difficult to make the transition to a professional role because it's difficult to be both pleasant and effective. When you're pleasant, people tend to underestimate your abilities." Then the last one, "Some women are successful because they fit the profile white males like. They are not assertive. They are not vocal. They do not see themselves as equals. Because these women are successful, people don't see continuing problems." And I might add just one more to this. It's not a quote, but again, Rosabeth Moss Cantor, I think it might, or it might be James Coleman, I'm not exactly sure. No, it's Cantor, talks about women who also choose the alternative of not being what men expect, but of being invisible, of becoming invisible X's or whatever, invisible women that take on the characteristics of the male society in order to be accepted. Okay, in addition to this, these messages, I have considered 4 talks that were given in 1987 by President Benson. And I think the titles in and of themselves are very revealing. One is to the young women of the church. One is to the mothers in Zion. One is to the fathers in Israel. And the fourth talk is to the young Aaronic priesthood. And I might just point out that Zion is a perfect society of pure in heart, where Israel is a doctrinal concept. But in addition to that, in a talk to the young women of the church, it says, teach your daughters to prepare for life's greatest career, that of homemaker, wife, and mother. Teach them to love home because you love home. Teach them the importance of being a full-time mother in the home. In the message to mothers in Zion, I quote, remember the counsel of President Kimball. Mary, you are to become a career woman in the greatest career on earth, that of homemaker, wife, and mother. It was never intended by the Lord that married women should compete with men in employment. They have far greater service to render. Numerous divorces can be traced directly to the day when the wife left home and went out into the world to employment. In the talks to Father in Israel, in a home where there is an able-bodied husband, he is expected to be the breadwinner. Sometimes we hear of husbands who have lost their jobs and expect their wives to go out of the home and work, even though the husband is still capable of providing for his family. We urge the husband to do all in his power to allow his wife to remain in the home caring for the children while he continues to provide for his family. Also, the need for education or material things does not justify the postponing of children or family in order to keep the wife working. It is with sheer fatigue of trying to resolve the contradictory message and the ambivalence that I finally stopped asking, why am I doing this? And started asking how to balance all of this in my life. As I look back, I am amazed that my goals have actually remained constant. In high school, I sloughed PE and I snuck into a calculus class. I went out for several months. Can you believe it? However, I was removed from the class. And my daughter asked me on the way up, how much did this affect you? Well, I graduated 19 in a class of over 500, so while I can't remember the exact grade from the PE class, I don't imagine that it affected my GPA or my future career that much. Before I mention that, I might say that one of my philosophies in getting through in science has been what a bishop once told me, and that is that it is easier to ask forgiveness than permission. And it was with this philosophy that I have entered many realms unknown to women. Okay, in addition, I would like to end with the two major doctrinal points that are come into question with the whole issue of science, with the whole issue of employment, and the whole issue of future encouragement: free agency and self-worth. Who are we? What are our needs? What experiences in this life promote our spiritual growth and the development of our individual talents? What is it that we have before us? I'd like to answer with the young women theme. We are daughters of a heavenly Father who loves us, and we love him. We will stand as witnesses of God at all times and in all things and all places as we strive to live the young women values, which are faith. I am a daughter of a heavenly Father who loves me, and I have faith that his eternal plan includes all of us. Divine nature. I have inherited divine qualities. as an intelligence which I strive to develop. Individual worth. I am of infinite worth. I have my own divine mission, and I will strive to fulfill this mission. Knowledge. I will continually seek opportunities for learning and for growth. Choice and accountability. I will remain free by choosing, and I will accept the responsibility for my choices. Good works. I will nurture others, and I will build the kingdom not only through righteous service and freedom, but in contribution of my individual talents, skills, and abilities. Integrity. I will have the moral courage to be true to myself. The second of these principles is self-direction, and I'd like to take a statement from research directed by my colleague Marie Cornwall. See, I'm implicating all of them in this, both Dr. Cooper and Dr. Cornwall. She says, women in our society and in the church learn through early socialization to be attuned to others. This interpersonal orientation, which early training for mothering encourages, contributes to women assuming responsibility for relationships. Sometimes it appears better to give in and make other people happy than to stand up for one's own opportunities and decide for yourself. The magnitude that this conflict can create cannot be underestimated. On one hand, it is important to have peaceful relationships with others. But on the other hand, everyone, and I believe this includes both men and women, must feel that they are at the same time directing their decisions and reaping the consequences. The essential nature of this feeling in subjective well-being is widely understood and documented. The critical nature of self-direction, self-determination, is in the LDS doctrine of salvation is apparent. The bottom line is that we must be ever wary of wasting a life, any life. We must socialize, we must teach, and we must provide institutional opportunities for all people, black or white, male or female, bond or free, to make free, unrestricted choices to develop their individual talents in whatever field that they find interesting, challenging, rewarding, and in which they can personally make a contribution.
Well, there are 100 things I'd like to ask or say, but I notice you've all politely kept your reactions to yourself to this moment, so we now have 15 minutes when you can address questions or make comments.
This is more of a comment, I suppose, and normally I would stay very quiet, but you push my buttons when you hit science, because I teach science, and it's a very strong issue for me. He made the comment that girls don't do well in the hard sciences, math and physics, chemistry, where they do okay in biology. And this is what we found. And I started to look back at why. And at the time, we noticed that the girls were equal, or at least somewhat equal. And then there seems to be a change about Boy Scout age. And when you start to look at these things that Boy Scouts are taught, magnetism, electricity, dirty cars and motion, light, reflection, stars, where the girls are now, my daughter learned how to make a cookbook. She's working on a quilt for the Festival of the Trees. These are not bad things, but they're not exactly what's going to progress this child to have some very decent skills. And I forgot how I was going to end it, but it's okay. I wondered if you had noticed the same problem. I guess that's what it was. The church, since it pushes Boy Scouts and Scouting, along with girls in math, are afraid to make mistakes. Girls have to be right. Well, boys can make a mistake. Yeah, no big deal. And so Boy Scouts, they can take off they're down to their skivvies, and they jump in the lake, and they're all over the place, and they're having fun, and it's church-sponsored. The girls go on camp. They have to wear shorts over their swimming suits. They have to be very, very careful about what they do and how they do it. And so girls, from their very early socialization, are taught to be right and proper and careful.
Any comment?
I'd like to say, yes, that is what we found. But I would like to distinguish between two things. Girls drop science earlier. And that those are some of the reasons. But the ones in that deviate and that persist end up actually doing better. You may have noticed that too in your classroom.
I'd recommend you sign your daughters up for Girl Scouts, too.
It's very difficult because Girl Scouts, there are very few LDS Girl Scout places, or they don't, there aren't even room for them.
I might mention that I used to be a Girl Scout leader, and I was told by a bishop maybe about 10 years ago that Girl Scouts supported heavily and contributed heavily to abortion movement, and that it was one of those organizations that is considered contrary to the, when you get asked in the interviews, do you support any organization?
He
told me, I think you should not only get out of Girl Scouts, but I needed to resign as the president of the League of Women Voters at the time, because they were also pro-VRA.
One more front row question.
I did. Obedient.
Marie, when you talked, you said, raised the question of hierarchy goes to the church. And then you talked just very briefly about the concept of religious community. Can you play with the idea of some alternatives? How can we keep order and at the same time avoid hierarchy?
Well, that's one of the interesting dilemmas. When you read the Zucker, for example, when he talks about organizational form, he talks about the fact that there comes a point when our way of thinking about problems becomes so set that any other alternative is not even available to our thinking, because we have such this strong vision. And I think probably to discover those ways, we would have to begin looking at alternative religious forms, or there are some feminists who are writing in terms of how do you get away from hierarchy. But one of the most interesting articles I've ever read was in a lesbian issue of Sex Roles. I think it was Sex Roles, but anyway, there's an article where this lesbian auto mechanic organization went through major trauma when it got large enough that it needed to begin to have a division of labor and a hierarchy, and the whole thing blew up because they couldn't maintain market share and be a viable organization and still hold to the feminist notion of no hierarchy. So it's a major dilemma for us. But I guess one of the things that I would like to say is I hear people talking about, well, you know what, we're beginning to say, well, if we just ordain women to the priesthood, that will give them access to the hierarchy. And I'm saying that is a liberal feminist perspective. Let's be more radical and say, what is the alternative to devising the community? And once we've changed the question, then we can discover the alternatives.
What are some radical possibilities?
Part of it is that our notion of American individualism gets in the way, too. That we, as Americans, we don't understand community. And the fact that it is possible for people to all be equal, not have equal opportunity, but to be equal in the sense that each person's contribution to the community is valued. And until we begin to try and discover what that contribution is and how that works, you want me to be specific, and I'm struggling with it.
No, I just want you to keep musing on this, because I agree that it's got to be radical, and I just don't know what.
How about as a start, just using terms like negotiation and consensus more than obedience and authority? Okay. And we do that anyway, to some extent. when we decide a ward picnic or who's going to be in what positions or whatever.
We do it on the local level.
That's right. Well, it occurs probably at every level to some degree, but maybe between levels we never use those terms.
What
we need to learn them.
What comes down from the top interferes with the negotiation.
Yeah.
And the
way we don't do it at all that we should maybe is between levels as well.
Comment. My children go to open classroom, which felt like Board of Education was trying to squash. They've got one more year to go, and I don't know what's going to happen then. But it was interesting to hear at their graduation. This is where parents have to give so many hours a week for each child that they have there. And the parents and the teachers and the children get together and decide what they're going to do. Okay? And they had more of a traditional principal involved. They had a hard time getting a principal. And she said at their graduation, I was trying to get a definition of what's going on here. This was very interesting to her. And she said, the definition is community. And we're all working together. The teacher was taking in, ideas from the children and the parents. And it wasn't, you get the idea, the teacher isn't over here directing everything. It's the community. And one more thing. Years ago, I started going with my husband for teaching. Because his companion never showed up, and sometimes he had to go to widows' houses, you know what that is. And I just started going, and I went 2 years, and then we were called in to the bishop, and he said, it's okay, you can keep going. I didn't know we had been discussed. It was wonderful to get permission, I presume.
Let me just say one thing in terms of rediscovering community and Mormonism. I would strongly suggest James Fowler's book, Become Your Belt, Become a Christian, because he talks about in there the difference between the focus on discovering what your major contribution is in life so that you can be better than anyone else and make the discoveries first, and discovering what your skills and contributions are and negotiating that with the community so that the community is better as a result of that. And I think it'd be interesting to take some time to discuss the implications of this book.
In the back.
I have two comments. One is, I was surprised to hear about equal opportunity for foreign decrees. I don't think that's the expression. I can say that we want in any society. And the second one is a comment on the British Commonwealth Commission. When my husband was in law school, he came home with his own city that women, children, women take from sailboats were all in the same section of law originally, but there had been a change. And there's now different sections for maritime.
They aren't my words.
You got that from the Book of Mormon, right?
Absolutely.
When there was, but yeah, the gentleman in the white shirt.
Comment and ask a question. As a scout leader, I took my troop of girls down to a power plant on a tour. 10-year-old girls, they hated it. All the science-oriented merit badges, they won't even consider. They want to do arts and dance and that kind of thing. So either I'm doing something wrong or 10 years old is going to get into
it.
My question is that I've heard that the view that priesthood leadership in the church is really a facade, and that on the fundamental level, the basic decisions are made by women. And that in a sense, we really live in a religious community, a matriarchal society.
I've heard that rumor too.
What kinds of decisions are made by women?
Most of the fundamental decisions in the home, I think, in a lot of families, are made by women. The father and husband is making decisions about world politics, and the mother is making decisions about what really goes on in the family.
I tried to bring out a little bit this notion of informal versus formal power. And then that happens in a lot of societies within the household. I've lived out in social, not in locality. And so you do have to be. But in terms of decision-making bodies of the church, it always passes through. to demand, you know, a formal decision, essentially. So,
the woman in the back.
Also, the informal power is that it's obvious. And so you can have a great deal of personal power and be a really study president and have a vision to actually go with it. And a vision can change and the power can go with it.
And the bishop can release you. You can't release the bishop. Who? Where? Where? Okay. Yeah.
I am a teacher of science, and I am fortunate to be in a private school where the majority of the faculty in science are women. And almost every year, our valedictorians, valedictorians, highest GPA students are female students. In my own particular class, I force my young men students to make basketry. I teach anthropology, and I make the girls hike 3 days into a Navajo ruin. And I don't accept, you know, that we don't like this thing. And my other comment was to Dr. Cornwall. I appreciated you touching on the difference between the ecclesiastical and the patriarchal priesthood, and I feel like that is the answer to the problems within, especially that the women deal with in this church. If men and women understood what the patriarchal priesthood is, the difference between the patriarchal priesthood and the ecclesiastical priesthood, and how to use how to set it forth in motion, I think that we need not look to any other solutions to our problems if we understand that fundamentally how Joseph Smith wanted it to be. And I appreciated you bringing that out. I also agree with you that as the church grows, the ecclesiastical priesthood becomes much more important simply because we need more bureaucrats. And that if we as women do not understand those fundamental differences between those priesthoods and how we fit in within, especially the patriarchal priesthood, I don't know what will happen, but we do have it within us already to cause fundamental change.
Well, I think it does provide you a little more freedom, for example, when you have an experience in your local ward with, say, the second councilor in the bishopric, and you recognize that much of that experience is the experience of the bureaucrat rather than a priest.
Keep that always in your mind, the hierarchy versus the patriarchal power of God.
We need to close this session. I would invite you all to meet the panelists and each other outside the door and continue the conversation. Thank you.